And let's go ahead and get started. Good morning. I'm Pat McClatchy. Welcome to this, our New York Cotton Market Roundtable. This is our 16th edition of this meeting. And this is the first time to hold the meeting from the New York Stock Exchange. We're very pleased to be here. ICE Futures US has always been the host of our program, and we decided we would do it from the New York Stock Exchange. So we appreciate their support. I want to recognize Brent Crossland and also Dave Farrell with ICE Futures US. We thank them for hosting us. The format for today will be we will go over crop conditions with our cotton panel, and then we'll have our special guest Joe Nicosia speak, and then we'll go to a question and answer period. If you're out there, you're watching, or if you're listening and you can go to the agmarketnetwork.net, you can watch us live, and you can submit questions through Twitter and Facebook, and we'll be happy to try to respond to those. Let's recognize our sponsors. We've got Bayer, who has been with us since the beginning, starting 16 years ago. Bayer is, just to tell you a little bit about them, and I think most people know who Bayer is, it's a global enterprise with core competencies in the life science fields of healthcare and agriculture. Its products and services are designed to benefit people and improve their quality of life. Bayer launched its innovative E3 sustainable cotton program in 2013. E3, a transparent, environmentally responsible, economically viable, and socially equitable program, provides guidelines for farmers in the United States who grow certified FiberMax or authentic Stoneville cotton. E3 takes the certified FiberMax and authentic Stoneville programs to the next level by allowing buyers to identify where their cotton was grown, utilizing proprietary certification database. As I mentioned, Brent Crossland is with us today. He is the head of fiber development, cotton op seed and fiber technology. Also, for the first time, we have a new sponsor. Ola Inc. is with us today, and Ola is was founded in 1959. Ola Inc. is a fabric sales, marketing, and consulting company based in New York City with offices in Los Angeles and Nashville, working for textile and apparel brands around the world. Ola Inc. is best known the Kingpin's Denim Shows, which are held twice a year in New York, Amsterdam, Hong Kong, and now Miami. Ola Inc. assists Bayer in the marketing of its E3 cotton program. And Andrew Ola is with us today. We welcome him. He's the CEO of Ola Inc. Also, we have Robert Anishag is managing director of Ola Inc. So we really appreciate their support for making this possible for you. So let's get started. I'm going to go ahead and introduce our panel, our cotton panel, and then I will introduce our special guest speaker a little bit later. Dr. O.A. Cleveland is professor emeritus, Mississippi State University. He's a very well-known cotton marketing expert. O.A. has been with us since the very start of our meeting here in New York. He will cover today the Southeast, the Mid-South, and the Delta. Then we have H.W. Kip Butts. He is senior cotton analyst and director of energy services with Informa Economics. This is his second year with us. He'll cover outside market influences in cotton right now. Gerald Nieper is president of Calcott. He's in his seventh year as president of the 84-year-old company, 84-year-old co-op. He's been with us since the first year of doing the cotton market roundtable. Gerald will cover California and the Southwest. Dr. John Robson is his first year being here in New York with us. He's professor and extension economist in cotton marketing at Texas A&M University. So let's go ahead and get started with O.A. and giving us his outlook for cotton in the Southeast and the Delta.
Great, Pat. Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity to be here. And certainly always want to thank ICE and Bayer and Ola for the sponsorship that made this work for us. But if we look at the crop, we've got a bigger crop than we had last year. It's off to a better start, but we should have a larger crop, and thank goodness, because we have larger acreages. But we've been blessed so far, staying with the Mid-South at first. The Mid-South got off to a wonderful start due to weather, And we got some great June rains, so that pushed that crop further. We're looking now at we are not suffering from any drought per se. There are always a little drought, a few droughty places, but each time, each week, each 2 weeks, we start to get a little dry. We've had good moisture, and that's carried us forward. The state of Mississippi has regained its traditional role as the leader of the Mid-South with respect to production. As we look at that crop this year, again, off to a great start, we're looking at a little bit over a million bales, and that'll be a real blessing, certainly a very major component of that economy. The second largest grower in the Mid-South now is Arkansas. They vibrated one or two with Mississippi for several years, but Mississippi had a very large increase this year. Arkansas is looking at a crop that will be approximately some 800,000 bales or so, so about 500,000 to 600,000 bales. But as we go through the Mid-South itself, the third largest producer, and this catches some people off guard, Missouri. Missouri has grown to become a major producer in the Mid-South. We're looking at a crop there of right at 4 million bales in the entire Mid-South, not in Missouri per se, but Missouri will have in excess of 400,000 bales this year. But the Mid-South is looking at about a little less than 4.1, but more than 4 million bales. That's a crop that the Mid-South will be very proud of this year. And again, to date, the weather has cooperated. We have good moisture. As we look to the southeast, the crop there is a little spottier. The acreage is not quite as large. I made a mistake a moment ago, as I do frequently. I said 4 million bales in the Mid-South. Mid-South crop's not quite that big. Mid-South crop's 3.3 million bales. It's the southeast that's looking at 4.2 million bales. Southeast is led, of course, by Georgia. The Georgia crop got off to a good start. The acreage in Georgia is the big question. Many in the cotton industry feel like that the USDA overestimated that acreage by as much as 50,000 acres. We'll wait and see. It was substantially larger than the March 31 planting intentions report. But USDA has a pretty good record, so we'll go with their number for right now. But with, as I say, the southeast with a little over 4 million bales, the mid-south with about 3.3 million bales, is going to give us a crop for those two major regions, a little over 7 million bales. So it's a crop that we feel like we can live with very well. We are a little bit concerned with the heat units. We've accumulated wonderful heat units, and that's put a beautiful plant out there for us through much of the Mid-South. The droughty problems, we're a little bit suspect in some parts of Georgia now. The Tennessee River Valley in Alabama is in the center of a droughty area, more so than probably any other significant cotton region in the Mid-South or the Southeast, for that matter. The nighttime temperature has now become very important because we're in a major pollination stage. Certainly the daytime temperatures are very hot and can cause problems and have caused problems in the past. But typically at this time we get more concerned about the nighttime temps, and we've got to get those temps down to 80 degrees at night, and we're having some difficulty doing that. So that could cause some pollination problems, which would lead to yield problems, but we won't know that. Mother Nature and the plant itself aren't going to tell us that for another month at least. We'll just have to see how that goes. So, Pat, that would be where I would come off with. We're looking at a crop, again, to duplicate that, my comments. The Mid-South crop, about 3.2, 3.3 million bales. The Southeast crop, about 4.1 million bales. Again, led by the big Georgia acreage.
Okay, let's go to Dr. John Robinson.
The situation in Kansas, Oklahoma, and Texas, and it's mainly Texas, is pretty typical for this time of year. After starting off with above-average planting moisture, we're now in a typical hot and typical dry and a typically uncertain production outcome situation. I'm speaking mainly because of all the dryland acreage that's in the region, especially in Texas. But there have been impacts. There have been headlines recently about the hot weather there and the lack of rain over the Texas growing regions, mostly in the month of July. And that's had various effects depending on what part of the state that we're in. In South Texas, it's just fine. They'll take all the hot weather they can get because their first bale was harvested back in June, and the general harvest is beginning now. And anecdotally, there are reports of above-average yields, above-average yield potential in the Rio Grande Valley and in many parts of the coastal bend. There are some reports of in the areas that got too much rain and not enough plant growth regulator and other chemicals. There are some issues with perhaps a little bit too much stalk and only working with a bottom crop, but that's a little bit further up the coast. Generally, the attitudes and feelings there are pretty good. If you move further north in Texas, in the central Texas region, which is mainly a dryland region, it's not a very large acreage, but it's kind of a bellwether for what's going to happen perhaps further north and west. The blacklands, they have like 600-pound yield potential, which for them is pretty good. A lot of that land is finished. The crop there is finished. That's about all it's going to make by reports. There are a few places in the Blacklands where if it was to rain in the next week or so, they might make another 50 pounds or more if that were to happen. And that kind of situation describes a much larger acreage to the north and the west. So if you were thinking about the Rolling Plains and the South Plains and the Panhandle region, particularly the dryland regions, are also in a situation where it could really swing from average to above average yields to very below average yields on that dryland, depending on what happens in the next several weeks. There's probably 2.5 million acres in NASS, one north, one south, two north, and two south, where it's been blooming. It probably started blooming about a week late, but it's at a critical situation now with water demand and the lack of rainfall has stressed those plants a lot. And so a lot will happen in what plays out rainfall-wise over the next couple of weeks. I might just throw in here that the dryland acreage in Oklahoma and Kansas is, by reports, a little bit better off than Texas because they got between 2 and 4 inches of rain in those producing regions during the month of July. So they're looking at above-average situations for their dryland. And all of the irrigated acreage in West Texas and Kansas and Oklahoma, the reports are they're looking for a pretty good outcome. So we're waiting to see on the weather and how that has an influence. This variability, you know, historically plays out with, it plays out statistically if you look at some of the better producing years, El Nino years like we had here, and I'm thinking of 4, 7, and 10. If you plug those abandonment and those yields onto the current acreage for Texas, you could get upwards of 7 million bales of production. Now, I think we're past that opportunity just with the heat stress that we've had. On the low end, if you just take a 5-year average, ignoring 2011, and plug in that abandonment, which is like 26%, and that 5-year average yield, you come out at 5.5. So I think there's pegging the extremes of what might happen in Texas, 5.5 million bales up towards 7. USDA, with their assumption of 10 to 12% abandonment, is sort of splitting the difference, I think, and plugging their abandonment number and 5-year average yields into Texas gives about 6.6, which I think is probably the upper end of my expectations, 6.6 or a little bit lower, unless we get some rain in the next couple of weeks. I think it'll be at least the September WASDE before we have a benchmark of what's really out there. Pat, that sums up what I had.
All right, let's go to Gerald Nieper.
Thank you, Pat. Fortunately, in the far west, we don't have a lot of challenges. The biggest challenge we had this year was we did have the El Nino rains, and it did put some good moisture in the mountains and snow, a good snowpack. But generally with these rains, you get bug pressure in early springtime. And so to the extent that California growers have had challenges, one of the challenges that they've had was with some ligus problems early, but that seems to be clearing up so far. Far northern Sacramento Valley, they look like they could possibly have a record yield up there. They're very encouraged about their crop. In the Central Valley of California, everybody's generally very, very pleased. I don't think it'll be a record-setting yield this year. I mean, the crop index is a little bit below where it was this time a year ago, but it's certainly going to be a very good very good yield year and yield for California growers. Moving over to Arizona, things are in pretty good shape over there. If you look at the crop index numbers, there's about 4 to 5% that they put into a very poor category, but that was a seed problem. I think they had some seed that was delivered that had very poor germ. Wasn't necessarily a weather problem. We did have some level 2 heat stress at a couple of days, but fortunately the crop was in a position to where it didn't suffer very much. The monsoons have set in. Temperatures have come down a little bit, and the crop is progressing very, very nicely. In fact, Arizona growers are very, very encouraged about their yield potentials this year, and that's borne out in the crop index condition survey. It's well above this time where it was this time a year ago, and so we're looking for a good yield over there. New Mexico, very similar to Arizona, they're progressing very nicely, and the acreage isn't quite as large, but the growers are very encouraged about their potential over there. Of course, we have both Pima and Upland in Arizona and California. Most of the crop in California is a Pima crop, very little Upland. Most of the crop in Arizona is an Upland crop, but the Pima looks very good in Arizona along with the Upland crop. Total production in the far west, Arizona, California, and New Mexico, a little over 600,000 bales of Upland between those three states, and a Pima crop pulling in a little bit of the Pima from the El Paso region of Texas, looking for a Pima production estimate of right around 570,000 bales. So, all told out there in the far west, probably about 1.1 million bales between Upland and Pima production. Pat, that would be my report.
Okay. We have asked Kip Butts to comment on some of the outside factors that are affecting the cotton market now. Kip?
Hi, thank you, Pat. Hello, everyone. This is a little different twist for me. Be talking about some of the things that are not cotton. We have to first just talk about the global economy, and there are four things Pat asked me to look at, and I decided to use four. One is the global economy and its subpar economic growth, particularly since the Great Recession. Consumer income is stagnating and in some places actually declining, which is not a good thing for cotton. The sporadic spec participation can at times have a dire impact on U.S. cotton prices, and fiber competition, which may be the most important part of this discussion, is also a big factor, kind of an outside market influence. Those of you that haven't been under a rock for the last few years know that the central banks responded to the recession, the Great Recession, with first QE 1, 2, 3, 4, down the road, zero interest rates, some places now negative interest rates, both in Europe and Japan. We did find out this week that Japan is not going to institute their helicopter money. But the EU, Draghi yesterday in his report, the president of the EU Central Bank, said that the risk was the downside for the economy and that they stood ready to infuse whatever was needed to get that done. The idea behind this, the whole thought is that maybe this zero interest rate, these extraordinary actions that are being taken, is having a negative impact on our consumers. What happens is, in my mind, if you have a worried consumer, a concerned consumer, you have a tight-fisted consumer not ready to go out and spend an awful lot of money. And that kind of bears itself out with the consumers' incomes that have slowed, stagnated, and in some cases gone down. This is mostly in the developed countries. That's where we see it the most. But there's been a little bit in some of the emerging markets as well, which is really sort of unusual. This has been going on actually well before the recession, so this has been a long-term problem. Looks like it's going to be like this for a while. This has been borne out in the June U.S. retail sales, where actually headline sales are pretty good at about 0.5%. What we didn't hear was, or wasn't well publicized, was that they brought May down significantly, revised it lower. And what we're most concerned with is the clothing and clothing accessories. It was down a full 1% for June, and that ties the worst decline we've had this calendar year on a monthly basis. And although retail sales are up a little over 2%, which is not bad, clothing and clothing accessories is actually flat for the year. Not a good indication that the consumer is wanting to go out and spend a lot of money for clothing and accessories. What we're stuck with is a very price-discriminating consumer. Specs, they can be very important. They are right now. Part of the central bank policy of zero interest rates and QEs has investors looking for yield. They're chasing yield. And with the low interest rates, it makes the environment very difficult. We're seeing them right now come back to the cotton market, or commodity market, I should say, partly on weather markets. Soybeans have benefited, cotton benefited to a degree. We've got a little rally on that now in the cotton market. And the point on this is there's an awful lot of room for these specs. If they want to come in here, they've got a lot of room to add a lot of contracts and perhaps move these prices a little bit higher than they are even now. Perhaps for most folks, the most important part of this is this conversation is the fiber competition. We all know that polyester is a huge competitor for cotton. Right now in China, the prices are about of polyester are about half of the landed price of the Chinese cotton index, and so that is a favored type commodity there. But that's not all. We've got bamboo now that's making a bit of a splash. We've got linen. We've got, and where it's legal, of course, hemp fibers. So there's some other competition out there. The Lycra, spandex, and so on just take small parts of the share, but the fact of the matter is they're stealing from cotton. And what we've seen over time is as these cotton prices go up, cotton loses share of the cotton spinning system. In the year 2000, we had about 40%. Of the spinning system share. The estimate that I have for 2016 is about 27.1. Typically, when we lose that share, when cotton loses that, you don't get it back. So there's a potential real problem with that. Sometimes people want to blame the retailers for this kind of thing. Why aren't you using cotton? The real problem is not the cotton products. I think people really enjoy and appreciate the cotton products. It's really a question of price. We can't really blame a retailer for using the lowest input cost when you've got a consumer that's struggling and looking for a low price point. So I guess one of the things, I know I sound a little bit like Donald Downer here, but that's not what I mean. This is a realistic, I think, view of where we are for the next year or a couple of years. And these are the things I think, particularly until we get the world economy to kind of grow at a little better rate, more to trend before the recession, we may be in a situation where cotton continues to struggle as far as its share on the marketing system. I think those are things we want to talk about.
All right. Well, thank you. Let's introduce our special guest. Joe Nicosia is our special guest speaker today. He's Executive Vice President of Louis Dreyfus Commodities, LLC. He serves as Senior Head of Cotton and Merchandising Platforms at Louis Dreyfus Companies, B.V. He has been Vice President of LDC Holdings, Inc. since 2010. He serves as Senior Platform Head of Cotton and Senior Head of Tropicals, merchant of Louis Dreyfus BV. I think most people would agree that Joe Nicosia is the foremost cotton expert in the world. He has joined us in the past. He was here with us last year and on several occasions in the past. So we thank Joe for being with us and giving us his outlook for the cotton market.
Well, thanks, Pat. It's going to be an interesting season going forward, especially from where we've been. Start of every season, we started with great expectations on how the supply and demand is going to turn out in the year ahead. These beliefs are what form our basis every day for our futures trading and our pricing decisions. Sometimes these expectations materialize and sometimes events alter them. Today we expect in 2016-17 a world production deficit. We have a much-needed drawdown in Chinese cotton stocks. We have limited Chinese cotton imports. We have a good U.S. crop of about 15.8 million bales and the best U.S. export program in 3 years despite the constrained Chinese participation on the import side. Well, these are all the expectations that we received from the USDA on July 12th. Since that report, futures have rallied from the mid-60s to the mid-70s. So will these expectations come to fruition? And if they do, are they consistent with a price level in the mid-70s? Before we answer those questions, let's take a look back and remember what happened this last season. In 2015, it wasn't a good year for growing cotton, either here or around the world. Last year's area was down about 10%, mainly in China and the United States. And worldwide yields were only 622 pounds, which are down 11% from the previous three-year average. The USDA estimates for 2015 had a world crop in July of 2015 estimated at 111.5 million bales. Today, that crop is estimated at only 98. That's a drop of 13.5 million bales from early expectations. Most of the losses occurred in just four countries: China, which lost 4.5 million bales, Pakistan down 3 million, India down 2.7, and the United States down 1.6. Seldom do we encounter such a drastic different level of production from early expectations. In the last 25 years, only once have we seen a bigger surprise, and that was in 2004, when the crop actually grew by 17 million bales from the July estimate. On average, we counter less than a 5 million bale difference between the preseason and the final estimates. Initial demand estimates weren't much better and were met with disappointment. In July of 2015, USDA estimated that we'd use 114.5 million bales for consumption for the year, but currently it's only at 110. The U.S. situation wasn't much better. We spent most of the year, and summed it all up in one word, sideways. Although our crop fell by 1.6 million bales, as mentioned, so did our demand. Early on, our expectations were for a 10.8 million bale exports, but we only finished with 9.2. So given how the 15-16 crop turned out, should we expect anything different from 2016? Well, the U.S. production outlook for 16 has obviously improved considerably during the last season. The rest of the world has not been so lucky. We currently expect the U.S. crop to be 15.8, a 2.9 million bale increase over last season. The world crop is expected to be at about 102.5 million bales. Of that 4.6 million bale increase that we have, and we saw the majority of it being in the United States, the world outside of the United States is going to go up only by 1.7 million bales. The major factors affecting our expectations for the 2016 world crop are significant improvement in area and yield prospects in the United States, but also a continued decline in Chinese cotton area, which now also includes decreases in its most important producing area of Xinjiang. Along with that, we see a large decrease in in Pakistan cotton area as a result of the bad crops from last year, and is currently a deficit monsoon outlook for the Gujarat area of India. According to the USDA, U.S. cotton area this year is up 1.4 million acres over last year, with a 500,000 of that being coming from the Delta and 0.8 being from Oklahoma and Texas. This figure is based on the June 30th acreage report. For the last 5 years, the average difference between June and the final outcome has been 440,000 acres. So the question of our acreage is still partly unsettled at this time. Most cotton area in the United States began the season with favorable soil moisture. I think everybody was very optimistic at the beginning of the year. Only a small portion of the often dry Texas High Plains was rated in the moderate drought category. Even SJV, as mentioned earlier, had some water allocations for improved snowpack, which allowed them to have more optimistic views than before. Overall, the 2016 crop was also planted later than normal. Much of the High Plains crop was planted very close to the final crop insurance dates, and as a result of very frequent rains that we had in May and June, it was also affected by below normal temperatures in May, which is going to delay the maturity of the crop not only in Texas but also in the Mid-South and Southeast. Although, as we all know, we are all experiencing way above normal temperatures today, and that has been beneficial in advancing the crop's maturity. But at the same time, as some High Plains agronomists have voiced concern about the length of the boll setting period due to the lack of current moisture. The conditions in the United States were rated 54% good to excellent this last week versus 54 a year ago. Texas and the High Plains in particular, though, represent an area of most concern right now. That region began the season with excellent soil moisture, as we have mentioned, and excellent plant stands. Although we did have some scattered rains last weekend, and this will help those who are able to receive it, the non-irrigated and semi-irrigated crops in this region will need rainfall soon in order to maintain its potential. The scary part here is that the most recent topsoil conditions were rated from 46 to 77% short in the four main areas of production in Texas. Our current production estimate is 15.8, with Pima production representing 560,000 bales. Now, the scary part about this is our upland production areas, we are estimating 4 million bales in the southeast and 3.3 in the mid-south. Now, if OA and I agree on anything, we finally agreed on something, that's really the scary part. So a timely rain in the right places would raise these current estimates and yields and our production estimates considerably. Weather during the next 60 days is going to be the most critical thing for this crop to reach its potential. With so much of the growing season remaining, especially with the late start, we could easily see a production swing of 1 million bales or more to either side from the current estimate. Turning to the rest of the world, Pakistan has reduced its cotton acres by over 10% this year as a result of last year's disastrous crop, which fell victim to excessive rains, whitefly, and pink bollworm infestation. The key question now is to what extent yields can recover from last year when they were down over 25% from the previous 3 years. Currently, the USDA has slashed that production outlook there to only 8 million bales. And although the production in Pakistan will be down, we believe that that is quite too low and too pessimistic. The situation in India was quite promising just a couple of weeks ago. Monsoon rains have not been able to reach regularly into Gujarat, which is one of the most important cotton-producing areas in the world. At this point, the forecast remains poor, and planting progress has been affected. The contraction in cotton area in China, though, has been one of the most remarkable developments in our industry in recent years. 8 years ago, China was growing over 15.3 million acres of cotton. This year, it's only going to plant 7.2 million acres. Even more remarkable is the fact that this area had already dropped to 10.9 million acres just a couple of years ago, while the state reserve was still guaranteeing $1.20 a pound for their cotton growers. Most of the losses in the Chinese have been in their interior provinces, which occurred because the farmers preferred to plant less labor-intensive crops, such as corn, and it also gave them the opportunity to take factory jobs if they so chose. These area losses continued as the reserve in China began to buy corn in 2014 and at the same time stopped buying cotton in 2015. It is unlikely that we will see much of this area ever come back to cotton. This has major implications for the market down the road, as China is still the world's largest consumer. China's cotton stocks are being worked down at a rapid rate, and in 2 or 3 years, we should see China become an importer of 15 million bales again per year. Now, if we look at the math on that, currently, according to USDA, China is going to grow around 22 million bales a year and consume around 35 million bales a year. So they have a structural deficit today of 13 million bales, which will also be met by imports of 4.5. But even with their very large ending stocks of 52 million bales estimated in July of 2017, it'll just take a couple of years before the reserve stocks are down to optimal levels, and then this deficit will have to be met solely with 100% of imports. Now, 2 or 3 years is an eternity in a commodity market, but it should be noted that this is coming. A key to this outlook in China, though, is resiliency, is its mainstay as a supplier of textile products and apparel to around the world. Cotton demand has been suffering headwinds for quite a few years now, mainly due to fashion trends, which have been favoring products made from man-made fiber since 2007. And polyester has had a strong price advantage over cotton in China, and it is still the largest supplier of textile and apparel to the world. 10 years ago, cotton usage peaked at 124 million bales. Today, despite the fact that we have 670 million more people in the world, cotton usage is only able to reach to 110. Today, we have a growth rate, and that's one positive thing. We're actually increasing with a growth rate of 1.3% in cotton usage per year. So that's the good news, that the headwinds seem to finally have died down, and we're approaching that to at least be able to grow with the world population growth of 1.2. The largest changes that we've seen, though, in the problems have been in women's fashion, where leggings, yoga pants, tights are just about as common as jeans now. Similar trends have been occurring in women's shirts. 10 years ago, the United States imported 2.8 million women's cotton knit shirts. Today, only 2.1. That's a 25% reduction of cotton imports for women's tops. Manufacturing has been just too easy to oblige to this new fashion trend. And unfortunately, China is still the largest supplier of textile products, which is being matched with the fact that they are also 73% of the world's polyester capacity. And of that, 28% of it is overbuilt and not even used yet. Polyester costs half as much as cotton to a Chinese mill. China has an advantage making and selling these type of products, and people currently want to buy them. This has been one of the reasons that cotton share has continued to struggle. The cotton blend level in China's spinning industry appears, though, to have bottomed out about 2 years ago and has actually slightly come back. However, this trend is threatened by the current high prices once again in China. China's domestic cotton price currently is at a substantial premium to the world price, and it has hurt the competitiveness of the Chinese textile companies. Since the State Reserve began selling out of its stock last May, they've offered 6.4 million bales and sold 6.3 million bales out of their reserve stocks. But currently the mills are petitioning to have these sales extended through September or even later. One of the key things is having additional supplies offered to the market at more competitive prices, and that will be important in determining the level of cotton consumption in China and in the world. But the big news last week from USDA was that they raised the export number by 1 million bales for 2016-17. To use a quote from them, they said, "Exports are expected to be sharply higher due to the larger U.S. supply and an expectation of continued tight foreign stocks." The futures market rose 3 cents on their report and continued to rise since then. Now we find ourselves in the mid-70s instead of in the mid-60 price level. So how tight are foreign stocks outside of China? It turns out that when we look at the production consumption deficit and calculate it outside of the United States and China, the deficit has actually shrunk from 10 million last year to 7.7 million bales this year. Is this compatible with an increase in U.S. exports from 9.2 to 11.5? Well, it's going to depend on the United States market share. It will also depend on price. Today, we find ourselves with a very different trading environment than just 2 weeks ago, when cotton is priced in the mid-70s versus the mid-60s. The U.S. program and the behavior of the board spreads can create a situation where the ownership of cotton is discouraged for two reasons. A higher adjusted world price, which means the owners of cotton in the United States cannot carry it in the loan for free. With the futures market in the mid to lower 60s, the adjusted world price hovers around the loan level, and the cost of carry for a bale of cotton is almost free. That's not the case when the futures are in the mid-70s. Today, we find that the adjusted world price is nearer, closer to 60 cents, far above the 52-cent loan level. Anyone owning a bale in this market environment has to pay the full cost of carry every month. The other reason today we find is that the board spreads are flat. This means that the futures market is not willing to pay carry for anyone who owns a bale. So this begs the question. So as we take a look at the number of sales on the books that we are making, are we making enough sales to justify an 11.5 million bale export figure for 2016? If we don't, then the futures market is solving a problem that we don't have yet, and the market may either have to fall in order to encourage that demand, or two, the spreads are going to have to widen so that someone can cover the cost of carrying a 15 million bale crop. Our unshipped sales for 2015 plus our new crop sales today amount to about 3.6 million statistical bales, which is roughly 31% of an 11.5 export forecast. At this point in time, for the last 4 years, our unshipped sales have amounted between 30 to 36, so 31% is roughly within this range. However, if we were to move towards the 36% level, that would cut down our projected exports to only 9.6 instead of the 11.5 currently estimated. Looking at it another way, are we making enough sales to justify the 11.5 million bale export figure? As we said, typically to ship 11.5 million bales, we'll have to sell 12.7. If we subtract out what has already been sold, we need to sell another 9.1 million bales or 170,000 bales a week. For this last month, we've actually been selling 253 million bales a week, so the answer here is yes, we are currently selling enough bales per week to get to the 11.5. And the 11.5 is also reasonable when we look at it on a share basis. If we look at 11.5, the United States will have to take roughly a third of all the business in the world, which is exactly the average we've had for the last 10 years. To be sure, there are developments that have preceded and coincided with the U.S. report, which have contributed to this recent price rally. COM prices have gone up not just here in the United States, but local markets in India, Pakistan, and China as well. For the next 15 days, the precipitation outlook on the high plains of Texas is quite poor, and high temperatures have been in the hundreds. We're all mindful of how a regime of high pressure can block the flow of moisture, and we're watching that and watching the forecast closely. The crop today is fine in West Texas, but in 2 weeks, we could start to see real losses. The Indian monsoon has had a weak advance into Gujarat, and the forecast there shows for little improvement. This is an extremely important development because India is the number one competitor in the world in the export market against the United States, and Gujarat is where a lot of the export cotton comes from. Planting progress there is already well behind, and a crop shortfall in Gujarat would be a boon to U.S. exports. China, too, has had too much rain in the Yangtze River area, and the crop there has been hurt. Earlier this week, one of the most important areas of cotton production left on the North China Plain was hit with 14 inches of rain, including 10 in one day. And the reason why this is important, because this is the area where the first cotton comes to the textile mills in China as their new crop begins once the reserve stops selling. So in conclusion, we find ourselves with three conflicting outlooks. One, we have a potentially large crop that is currently in great danger in the United States and in desperate need of rain. Two, we have a bearish China outlook where a total supply situation, as we all know, of over 60 million bales in an oversupply, and a reserve stocks are now being available to be sold. But in the longer term, deficits and large ones coming. And then three, we have a world situation outside of China and the United States that is relatively tight and could be an advantage for the United States exports. The next 45 days will show us which of these paths we will go down. Every year we start with great expectations, then nature shows us the way, and in the months ahead, this will surely be the case again. Pat, thank you.
Thank you, Joe. Well, let's open it up for questions, and we do have a few that have come in, but we have not talked about cotton prices. Well, let's talk about that. I think so many people tune in to hear where is cotton going. And so let's talk about that. How high can we go? We've seen a tremendous move up in cotton over the last 2 weeks. Are we at a level now where we're going to stall out, and is that it? Joe, what are your thoughts on prices?
Today we find ourselves in a situation where we've seen a great deal of spec involvement in the marketplace. I think that we have to be careful to respect that just because we have managed money and speculative money doesn't mean that it's not intelligent money, doesn't mean that it's not correct. I think the marketplace is really going to be start to focus come Monday on the U.S. weather. The Texas situation in West Texas is starting to become critical. It doesn't need rain on Monday, but it needs rain in the next 10 to 14 days, or we're going to have substantial losses. So can the prices move higher? I think that they can. I think that in general the hedging and the hedger is pretty much done what he needs to do. So in the very short term, the next 2 weeks, I think the money flow and the money that's been committed to commodities in those last several months has been substantial. I think that the money flow is going to show us the direction of where we're going. Longer term, I do think that there is a brighter outlook for cotton prices in the years ahead, again, substantially based on the fact that China, as they work through their oversupply situation, will become a very large structural deficit country again. The world, as we see, has not been able to increase its acres. Mid 70 cents probably will start to bring some acreage back into it, but we know in the 60s, high 60s, mid 60s, that's not a price that is high enough for people to expand acres. So it's going to be difficult if yields, if we don't have great yields for the world to be able to grow as much cotton as what we use. So in the very short term, I think prices are going to be totally driven by the weather and the money flow. But longer term, again, as we look 2 years down the road, I think the outlook is pretty bright for cotton pricing.
Okay, I see right now December cotton is trading at 72.23. Oh wait, what is your range for cotton's value now?
Well, I was impressed with Joe saying we finally agreed on something. And I basically, after listening to his comments, I just say I'm finally glad he got it right. I wish I could say as eloquently what he just said, because I cannot do anything but agree with it 100%. We have potentially we have a very bright outlook down the road. I think because of supply problems around the globe, we also have a very bright outlook. We do have a couple of hurdles this year we have to get through, and as he mentioned, the Chinese stock. So, yeah, we have the ability with Mother Nature not giving us any rain here in West Texas for the next couple of maybe even 3 weeks. Maybe this market can go to 85 cents. That's too high for me. And I know already I'll be quoted as saying Cleveland says it's going to 85 cents. I don't think it will, but who knows, particularly with the disappearance of Chinese stocks. But this market has a firm base, I would say, and we can begin to push in the upper 70s a little bit more, but we have to be terribly concerned about losing market share to the chemical fibers as we get up into this price level.
Okay. Anybody else? Gerald, you have any thoughts on the market?
a lot of thoughts. I guess putting some numbers together here recently, I'm having trouble coming up with USDA's numbers. Joe said earlier, you know, Chinese ending stocks at the end of next year, you know, 52 million bales. Well, that's where my stocks are today in China, and I can't quite figure out where I'm missing numbers over there. But so I think things are a little tighter in China than we give them credit for. I don't think that's driving the money flow into the commodity market necessarily, but, you know, something certainly is. I would agree with OA. I think we're a little too high right now. I mean, it's discouraging sales of cotton a little bit right now until the mills come to grips with the fact that you know, prices weren't going to stay in the 60s forever. With the weather situation, there's no reason to be an aggressive seller here until you get some indication that the crop is going to improve. With the nervousness in West Texas, there's just not a real reason to be a big seller. But the higher you push this market, you know, the hedgers are going to be there, I think, to the extent that you've still got some of the crop to sell. So I would say 78 to 79 cents possibly over the next 30 to 45 days. And, you know, maybe for the entire marketing year, you know, 65 to 68 cents on the low side and probably 75 to 78 cents on the high side. But this market always surprises us by going a little bit further in either direction than we anticipate this early in the season.
Any other thoughts on price?
I would agree with that, given all the highlighted uncertainties, I mean, from weak demand fundamentals to all the production questions that have been, you know, discussed, there would be a wider possible range for prices. So I agree with a 65 to upper 70s sort of range.
Can't argue with any of that. I got nothing to add.
Okay. Yeah, we have a number of questions that have come in from farmers, and it's basically the same question. And that is, do we hedge here or later? Joe?
Well, I think hedging is always, whether you hedge or not, is partly has to do with what your plan is for your own farm and how you want to run your business. From a pure hedging standpoint, I think if you look at prices in the mid-70s and you look at equity values of where they're at, they're substantially higher than anyone expected in the United States that they were going to receive this year. So I think doing nothing is wrong. I would hedge some to where things are, either in selling your equities, in hedging the crop on the board, of selling it outright. And it doesn't have to be 100% of what you have, but I think it's a great place to at least have something locked into. I think that's one of the reasons why I struggle with the ability to be in the mid-70s and yet have board spreads flat. because even if we cut 1 million bales off of the U.S. crop and we start to tighten things up, someone's still going to have to carry almost 15 million bales day one at harvest, and that's not going to be easy to do because it's expensive to hold cotton if the marketplace isn't going to pay you to do it. So at some point in time, we're going to have to put carry in the board, and then the only way to do that is the front end has to come down a little or the back end has to go up. In the short term, the speculative flow of money can push the prices substantially higher, just as Gerald said, and we don't know how high is high. I think the majority of the hedging is out of the way already, so that if there is a larger push up, it'll be able to go up easier, quicker. But the longs are already highly invested into that side of the board. So from a farming standpoint, I think this is a great opportunity to lock in reasonable returns. And if we push much, much higher in the deferred years, maybe even they'll look a little bit to selling some 17. You know, the U.S. producer tends to be very short-focused on their hedging decisions. Like you look at other places of the world, Brazil and Australia in particularly, the growers there market their crops 16, 17, 2018, 2019. They're marketing stuff forward in years where they see reasonable prices that they can make a reasonable return at. And I think the United States farmer should also start to be a little bit more forward-looking to what it does. And if you're more bullish after you lock in 15, 16 cent equities, then you can always turn around and buy a call spread, I think, to protect yourself for some additional upside move. But, yeah, I think it's a great opportunity to get some stuff sold.
Okay. We've got another question here, and this is for anyone on our panel. It's a question about sustainability. There's been quite a bit that's been said about sustainability over the last year or two. And here's the question. Is sustainability in textiles simply a fad, or is it the new reality for textile companies, brands, and retailers? And I would ask Bob Anishak to respond to that.
Thanks, Pat. It's definitely become a buzzword downstream. And again, I think it's also become an approach for some companies to distinguish cotton from, say, synthetics. In other words, it's a way to in a very crowded market, to be able to help cotton to distinguish itself and to stand out. Sustainability in and of itself is something that obviously many U.S. farmers, most U.S. farmers for sure, practice those techniques, and it's an important aspect and an important acknowledgement for the growing practices that are maintained here in the U.S. in particular. That's a very strong message, I think, to be brought downstream. And I'd ask my colleague Andrew Ola to chime in as well, because he sees this day in and day out in terms of how cotton is perceived in the marketplace downstream and a lot of these competitive factors. So I was going to say, you want to...
I think in general, consumer, and I'm talking from the consumer side, that the demand for products generally is that people want to know more and more about the products, whether it's a car or whether it's clothing. And as we go down this path, having sustainable products is essential to consumer goods.
Yep. One other thing, and I would agree with the sentiments, but I think it's important to realize in the world that we live in today, because I would add another word to the sustainable, which is traceable as well. And it began with food. It's growing in food, where people want to know where their products are from, what they're made of, whether they're genetically modified or not. We see that Congress has recently passed a bill addressing the same issue as states were addressing this issue, and the same thing's happening all the way down to apparel as well. People want to know more about the products that they're buying, so when you ask about is this real or is sustainable, the answer is going to be yes, it's here. But it's traceability as well. And today we have both the technology and we also have the IT systems that allow us to become and track our products more in the future. More labeling is going to be required, so it's here to stay, and we have to continually adjust our way around it. Now, the good news about that is that from a sustainable standpoint, the United States and its cotton production mostly qualifies as some of the best sustainable products that are made in the world. So we do have a bit of a marketing advantage that's there coming out of the United States, and it's something that we should exploit to the best of our ability to gain market share.
Okay. And I would just add on the traceability side, I think the United States is really, really well equipped to supply traceable cotton in a large scale versus the other growing major cotton areas.
Pat, if I can, just try not to duplicate, try to add something to the comment. I think that was my first thought, too, was traceability. And from the standpoint of around the globe, you look at a $10, $12 shirt that's being produced or being sold, and how much margin of error can there be to pay a Myanmar or a Laotian employee a fair wage? Now, that's something we don't have to face here in the United States, but cotton has to face that in the marketplace every day. As Joe Kip pointed out, cotton is selling for double what polyester is to the textile mill. And the textile mill is doing what they would do if I were them. They're looking after their margin. But traceability is what we've lacked. And the buzzword has been sustainability. It's going to be there. And as they both pointed out, sustainability, the U.S. cotton grower produces at as sustainable level as any grower in the world. And as Joe pointed out, cotton is as sustainable as any crop production in the world. Maybe at the margin there's some differences, but in general, that's a general comment. So it's not a production issue. It's become a textile issue, and it's amazing that the textile industry or the petrochemical industry or the polyester industry, whatever tag we can put on that, has been able to convince the consumer of what a wonderful product it has and what a sustainable product it has, yet it has all this TPA, this acidic wastewater coming from a crude oil derivative product that it manufactures, and all the problems it's there, yet cotton has been perceived by many in the textile industry because of the margins that are so important to them, that cotton is the inferior product. And as Cotton Incorporated and Andrew and their groups have shown, that cotton can match any of the qualities that these new active fabrics have. But the problem we face is the price of cotton vis-a-vis the price of polyester. Traceability, sustainability, but you've got to have that traceability.
And I think that this issue is going to be more important going forward. For the first time in the last couple of years, we're actually seeing some retail pull demand for cotton and of particular cottons, because they want to be able to tell the story too. They want to be able to say, if you're buying something made in the USA, made from USA cotton, the problem was before is how could they prove it? You know, when the product came back, because the majority of the products are being imported from overseas, and we don't have necessarily that ability to make sure what's happening in an overseas factory. But now the technology is changing where we can take our product, we can label it, we can trace it all the way there, all the way back. And the retailer says that they can receive a premium if we can tell the real story, and that the consumer will pay for a made from the USA, a USA-made product. Now it's up to our industry to be able to prove that traceability back, get it on the shelf, show that it's a quality product, and I think we're going to see more and more of that coming down in the future.
Can I just say one thing to what Joe and OA was saying, Pat? One of the things we've observed is that within the cotton industry, there are a lot of different marketing initiatives. And even though each initiative means well, it's playing to a constituency, they're really adamant about their particular product, in aggregate, the cotton message comes across as a one that can be very conflicted in the eyes of would-be textile buyers. With cotton, whereas with synthetics, it's a question of meeting a fashion demand and price point. With cotton, sometimes it's a more complicated question, which gets back again to Joe's points about transparency, which is very critical. But there's also the question of when buyers are confronted with, do we purchase organic cotton? Do we purchase, what are the issues in terms of purchasing GMO cotton, different varieties of cotton, some cotton that's produced under certain standards and others aren't. it becomes a little bit of a clouded kind of message and a conflicted message, and there are times it opens up the possibility for disinformation about cotton to get into the marketplace.
Yeah, and if I could add, Bob, I think to Joe's point, I think that's one of the things that we have going for us as an advantage of the U.S. is we can measure those changes and improvements. So it's not just about traceability, about where did that cotton come from, but also with these new initiatives, we're saving water, we're saving energy, we're doing all these things that are green, and we can prove it. So I think that's a major advantage we have versus a lot of the other countries.
And if I can, let me amplify, I attempted to, but didn't get it done, amplify on the meaning of traceability, not just where it comes from, but where the textile product comes from. And you take cotton or you take polyester and whatever your margin is, what you sell that product for, and you want to be sustainable and you want to be a fiber that represents the future, are you paying the employees a fair wage? And you're not getting that done in Myanmar with a $10 shirt. You're not getting that done in Laos with a $10 shirt. Wages in China have increased, and we're driving out a lot of the textile industry into Vietnam because the wages in China have gotten too high, yet wages in China are low compared to us. So, again, if you want to talk about, quote-unquote, sustainability, we have to add Joe's comment about traceability, but we've also got to understand if we want to be a socioeconomic fiber, and that seems what the world wants us to be, we have to also make our contribution to the individual employee and with a fair wage. Pardon me for my soapbox.
Okay. Any other comments about this or really any other subject? Okay. Well, let's conclude this and say thanks to ICE Futures U.S. for hosting us here. Also, our thanks to our sponsors, Bayer and Ola Inc. I want to recognize Brent Crossland, Andrew Ola, and Bob Anishak for being with us and making a contribution here. Thanks to our cotton panel, Dr. O.A. Cleveland, Joe Nieper, Kip Butts, and Dr. John Robinson. Thanks to you for being with us. This will be archived today and be on our site. And that really concludes our meeting. Thanks to everyone for being with us.
Thank you, Pat.
Thank you, Pat.
Thank you, Pat.
Thank you very much.